learning curve for me, but like for the third time, I was actually fluent in what's actually happening and knew what to do. But one thing I've seen, there has been a recent move in different campuses across North America, including one of the top schools in California, that the first year is getting more engaged so that you're exposed to a whole variety of issues, disciplines, programs, so that makes your eyes open to see like what is actually that you really want to do. And necessarily, you don't have to pick your major by the second year. But of course, this is a long-term process and it needs a lot of backup and support. And the student caucus this year is also from one of the senators is pushing for first year experience as well. Thank you.
Just for the benefit of those listening on the radio, I'm just going to quickly reread the question. And the question was, what's the most important academic issue facing students as they move on from first year and start to choose their major? And how would you help better this experience if elected to the Senate? Go ahead, Imran.
Right. So this is actually a big topic that I'm running for in my platform. And I want to push for student-run academic forums. Like going into second year, going to third year, a lot of students do want to transfer faculties when they realize it's not what they want to do. And when you talk to your advisors and when you look online, you'll only find, as you said, like solid information saying this is the exact, this is the competitive average, this is what you need. But no one really tells you the other things, the supplemental things, like what you should really do, work experience, what you should say when you're applying, how your paragraph should be. And I think student recommendations are a lot more relatable. And students will use that more than they would from an advisor aspect, and that's huge. So we need student academic forums, official ones that the UBC would start.
I can actually relate to this question a lot because coming in as a first year, I thought I would be doing something very different. I was convinced I was going to be a scientist, and that's changed dramatically. But I think a crucial element of the solution is to allow a broad sampling of courses, and Credit TFAIL has been a good part of that, of you can now take courses without fearing a great deal of academic backlash if you don't do well on them. But I would actually counter what you just said, Imran, about advising is a great place to start with that. I mean, the advisors know what they're talking about. And while students are a good resource, advisors know exactly what's necessary for applying, as the student back there was saying, for application to different programs. So strengthening and expanding advising in all faculties would be a great place to start.
Thomas, I actually disagree with your point a little bit. I don't think the advising offices help as much as they claim to do. Personally, in my experiences with them, I've gone to the advising offices, not been informed really of anything. They just refer me back to the website and then go to the website and not get the information. So if I had to try to help first-year students choosing their majors, what I would do is relook at the advising structure and try to train the advising officers and try to re-correct the website so that we can actually get information on it. I don't think forums are the way to go. I think we should actually correct the advising system. Thank you.
As the current AMS tutoring coordinator, I've actually worked with advising very closely, and the point is most advising units across campus don't know what other advising units are doing. So first of all, we really need a comprehensive program to unify advising programs across campus, be it departmental advising, faculty advising, and even Brock Hall. They're all working in solitary silos, and that's been a big problem. Students are the ones who are losing when advisors just send you off to another building. It takes them maybe 30 seconds to maybe look something up and 30 minutes for you to walk from one building to another. So advisors really need to be empowered to help students, and they really need to remember that their mandate is to advise, not simply redirect to a website.
All right, and I'll go ahead with rebuttal, starting with Spencer.
Pass.
I just want to add a quick comment to what Ryan mentioned. In fact, that is true, that, and I would see it as a lack of resources. And there are so many students, and it's an unfortunate to see a big lineup at the arts advising session whenever you're passing there, but this is something that we should look into, just as Justin mentioned. Thank you.
Actually, Ryan, I think we agree. That's what I meant by expand and make better. There need to be more advisors so you can see and advise more quickly, but they also need to know better what they're talking about. I won't name names, but one of my faculties is much better at directing me to real information than is the other. And that's because they actually take the time to look up the issue and not just pass me back to the other one. Thanks.
All right. I guess I misunderstood you. Basically, what we need to do is work as a team, as Senate is. And I think we are all trying to argue the same point on this issue.
Oh, no rebuttal.
Yeah. All right, fantastic. Thank you for your answers. All right, the next question actually came to me from one of the students, and I reworded into something that's a little bit more of an understanding, but it was very interesting actually to hear this come from a first-year student. In May 2008, and actually for the second time, the Senate considered a motion to remove the requirement for BC students to complete provincial exams not required for high school graduation to gain admission to UBC. This motion passed, and this policy took effect in September 2009. Since then, admission averages have risen in nearly all faculties. Do you agree with the decision that UBC made to remove the provincial examination requirement, and why? And we'll start with AJ.
This subject came up recently in one of the Senate meetings, I think, again, and the wording to that was actually that the minimum requirement average has been increased for like a couple of percentage. But if you look at the averages that we had seen for the past couple of years, after the admission process being done, they're going sky high. But at the same time, there is an inflation and deflation of marks across different schools, which is an understandable fact. But the reason behind that was that there is no actual comparison method between different provinces if there is such a system. And I hope it works out in the long term towards the benefit of students. And thank you.
I do disagree with taking off the provincial exams as a requirement. I feel that if we are looking for the academically best, academically gifted students, we need an examination that keeps them all on the even keel and that we can actually see how good they actually are compared to every other student in BC. We know that every high school is different. If you take a high school in Delta, you take a high school in Abbotsford, it's going to be a different standard of teaching, same curriculum, different standard. And a provisional exam keeps that even, and we need those with students going forward.
Yeah, I agree that we need a standard across the board measure to check out the academic performance of students in their high school careers. But it is something to look at to make sure that students from BC are being treated the same as students from Alberta and from Ontario and from international high schools. So the provincial exam is one way to do that, but there are other ways that we could look at. Anyway, thanks.
Personally, I don't agree with removing the provincial exam, but that's my opinion. What no one has really mentioned is the issue is a little bit broader than has been addressed. Basically, besides the provincial exam issue, how they're looking at correcting it right now was whether they should institute broad-based admissions in some faculties. And it does work for commerce. I know that in commerce, you have these broad-based admissions. Basically, the issue with that system in correcting the problem is this system will not be economically feasible for the university. Frankly, if you have to have people be hired to read these essays of all the students coming in, that also is going to become, will make admissions averages much more difficult to do. Yeah.
First of all, part of this problem is not localized to UBC. It's a province-wide problem. The writing is on the wall. There aren't the finances to continue holding the provincial examination programs, especially with decreasing enrollment. I'm sure some of you know, in at least the VSB, facing school closures. So the writing is on the wall for provincial examinations. The race is on to figure out a new solution. I think broad-based admissions can be a very good way to have a more diverse and vibrant student community. We're not only looking for students who have the highest grades. That's a given. UBC has the best people. You sitting here, you guys are here because you have high grades. We also want people who are going to be world leaders, and I think broad-based admissions is a great way for us to work towards that.
So this came to Senate before my time, but based on what I already know, I would actually tend to agree with the decision. First, I'd say that with regard to the increasing averages, correlation isn't causation, and since I haven't heard anything else, I'm going to reserve my judgment on that. But I agree with the principle of leveling the playing field, but since UBC gives you conditional acceptance far before your exams are actually marked, it didn't actually serve that function. And so you would actually be admitted based on your interim marks given to you by your high school teachers, and then you would only lose that conditional admission if you drop below a certain percentage after your final exams had already come in.
All right, awesome. Now we'll have 30 seconds if you want to go ahead and do some rebuttals. AJ?
I'm passing.
Pass.
No rebuttal.
All right, great. So move on to the next question. It's a little bit more general. The Senate is a huge body comprised of dozens of students, faculty, and administrators. I believe there's about 95 at the last time I tried to count, which is considerable. However, this group regularly comes together to deliver massive improvements that benefit students, such as the credit defail system implemented in March 2009. What do you think the Senate's current top priority should be for students, and why? And we'll start with Imran.
I believe that the top priority that we should be looking at in the upcoming year are the rising dropout rates. Recently, there was a study published where in year 1, 2, 3, the dropout rates were about 50%. And they did tackle that by raising the admission average from 67 to 70. But I don't feel that's the right way to do it. I feel they need to connect to students on a grassroots level in high school so they know what to expect in university. I don't feel they know what to expect when they get here, academic-wise, social-wise. They don't really find a balance. And that's also why the student involvement levels are where they are. Students either come to university and they get super focused, they get super academically oriented, or they take the other route and they can't handle the work and they just gear off and end up dropping out. That's why we have this complete split 50-50. So I think we have to focus on that so we can involve students more and solve the dropout rate problem.
I mean, the Senate addresses any number of important issues, and that's why it's important for each student senator to very much focus on one project. Mine would be, as I've said, to make the exam schedule public before classes even start so that we can avoid having financial hardship brought by having to book, you know, flights home and all that so late in the term. So that would be my number one priority as a senator. It's not quite the answer to the question, but that's all right.
As far as what my fellow senator said about the dropout rate, basically, I think this is part of a bigger problem, and that is the way education is looked at UBC. I know there's a huge disparity. There's some teachers who are excellent, and they fully deserve the Killam Teaching Awards that they receive. However, I've definitely been to, and I know other, it's through all faculties, you go to classes, you don't really understand what the instructor said, you go home, you go to the tutorials, those don't really help. What you need to do is try to reassess the education and ensure that the quality of teaching that each instructor focuses on is their utmost concern, above and beyond the research duties that they may have. If they're a teacher of a course, they should teach it.
So I'm also running for VP Academic University Affairs, and two issues that really touch this are student evaluations of teaching. The Supreme Court has recently ruled in favor of UBC allowing us to use student evaluations of teaching in promotions and tenure. Now the next step is to really get instructors to release these to students. So before you register for your next class, you should be allowed to see how your instructor did on those student evaluations of teaching. The next thing is our governance crisis. We are going to have to reevaluate how governance on campus is done. Currently, the bicameral system is Senate does issues of academic import, and BOG does issues of finance and property. And so that's going to be a big issue that will probably hit Senate next year.
I'll echo Justin's theme about governance there. Specifically, I think the biggest issue Senate needs to focus on is itself. Whereas the board has three student representatives counting UBCO, and the faculties have a huge challenge getting student input. 17 out of the, I believe, 87, although I could be wrong, total senators are students. There's faculty input. There's administration. And it's a place where these all and alumni work together collaboratively addressing these issues. The university needs more Senate. And the premise of the question of the universe of the Senate regularly coming together to deliver massive improvements for students just isn't true. It doesn't do this often, and that's one of the few examples over the past few years.
Just as Spencer mentioned and Eric mentioned, there's a big problem with the Senate is the vast number of people sitting on it and the procedure to get any sort of motion on the table. The motion does not go on the table the next day that you decided it's going to go. There's at least a couple of months that it has to go through various committees as well as going all the way through the agenda and then decided going to the Senate. And it needs a couple of approvals or it goes around a couple of rejections. So that process should makes it a little easier. That would essentially help out. But again, consider everything as a team job and a team board. It needs a lot of time. And I guess what we have started in this student caucus should be continued going further in terms of sustainability course code, summer project, and first year evaluation. Thank you.
All right, awesome. And then we can go ahead and have time for a rebuttal if you want to add anything as well.
I'll pass.
AJ, actually, I want to discuss something you said. I just want to make sure that it's clear that I think the committees and the way that the process works is a good thing. It should take time. You have to have assessment of what people want. You have to have consultation before you bring something and try to decide on it. It's called responsibility and accountability.
Well, I wasn't implying that we're going to do it like one person should decide for the whole 47,000 population of the campus. But the process could be a little time-consuming, which essentially wastes so much of resources and so much time of students. My simple suggestion would be if you start something when you're in first year, I'm pretty sure there's no way you can see that by the time you are in third year or fourth year.
No rebuttal.
Just with regard to scheduling exams, when you pick classes, I'm not necessarily against the idea, but there is one difficulty that I just want to make sure that the folks understand. Part of the reason that exams are scheduled after we've already signed up is that we know exactly how many people are in the course. When we know exactly how many people are in the courses, we can schedule exams in the classrooms that make the most sense, make the most efficient use, and therefore.
You can finish. We have an extra time. Just finish your sentence.
make the most efficient use of classroom and keep the exam period as short as possible.
Excellent. Thanks. Go ahead, AJ.
So I'm just going to add a quick answer to Imran regarding the dropout rates. In fact, I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing, but UBC is actually capitalizing on that with an over-enrollment. And one simple example of that was actually when there was a recession last year, UBC got into an issue so that they had like a 4% over enrollment with the hope that the student would drop out, but they could not find a job and they stayed in.
I mean, that's you have to take into account what you feel is more important, the business aspect or the actual academic aspect. It's why you come to UBC. Is it to get an education or is it to make this place richer than it already is, right? If it's to get an education, then we have to solve the dropout rates. We have to get the best students here, keep them here, and make sure they're involved to make other students enjoy their time even more, not just make this place richer than it already is. Like, that's what market housing is doing, right?
All right. So that was the final question. So right now we're going to have a chance for 30 seconds of closing remarks to talk about your platform and whatnot. So we're going to start that with Thomas and then go Ryan and then back down the line. So, yeah, feel free to add anything you'd like to add about the debate question you just answered or the rest of your platform. Thanks.
Sure. I'll just respond quickly to what Spencer was saying because he was stressing what I was saying about exam scheduling. Is that it is a complex issue. It's just it's a trade-off between whether you want whether you want efficient use of class space or you want students to not have to experience the financial hardship of scheduling exams late and the undue stress that causes. Other major universities do it, and it's a common sense issue. Again, this is one of many things I'll be pushing for if you vote me a senator. I'm Thomas Brennan. Thank you very much.
All right. Basically, I'm just going to reiterate my platform. I wanted to increase the undergraduate involvement in research. and I want to take a closer look at the education requirements and how teachers go about assessing their quality at UBC. But basically, the most important thing is Seneta is a team activity. We have to work together. Basically, we have to do our best to reach a common goal and actually improve student efforts at UBC. Thank you.
So I'm running for Senate, to sit on Senate again. For the same reason, I'm running for VP Academic University Affairs. I think academics on campus matter, and I think students need to be enabled to succeed. I really want to look at policies that are impeding students from succeeding academically and really to fix those. This will be my second year in Senate, and I'm hoping that this year will be a really exciting year for change, especially with the new governance discussions coming up.
Thomas, I'm definitely sympathetic to the financial hardship point. I just wanted to make sure that administrative difficulty and that trade-off was understood, although I'm not sure I succeeded in there. So my name is Spencer Aspison. I hope to get your vote, and I hope to be able to provide continued leadership for the Student Senate Caucus next year. And at the risk of slate-like behavior, I'm also really looking forward to the team that we'll have next year.
I want to extend the biggest appreciation to the first-year student who made this a step from coming here. That's a good cause, and thank you so much, all. Check for the detail, ourubc.ca, and the name is AJ Hajian. Thank you.
All right, so thank you, everyone, for coming. And again, my name is Imran Habib. I'd like to reiterate the main fact that I do believe we need student-run academic forums. I think this is really important. A couple problems that came up, this seems like a really good solution. And yeah, I'm looking forward to your support come election time. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks very much to all of our Senate candidates, and thank you all for watching the debate. So just to give you an idea, we're going to have candidates ready, and our moderator, Dr. Baum, from coming up and getting him a little bit coached on how we're going to run this thing. And then we'll be back together for the VP external debate in a couple minutes. Thanks.
Debate for the UBC Senate members. We had the members that we had here, sorry about that, were, let me just pull up their names here. The ones debating were Ryan Bredin, Thomas Brennan, Imran Habib, AJ Hajan, Spencer Rasmussen, and Justin Yang. And so these five candidates discussed what changes they would make in the UBC Senate, what policies they found important, how they felt about UBC's policy of no longer looking at BC provincial exams as a admission requirement, and also interacted with the first-year students in the crowd, asking what they felt first-year concerns were and how these could be addressed by the Senate. So I'm Claire Eagle. I'm joined with Iqbal Ahmed, broadcasting live from the Totem Park Residence Ballroom on CITR 101.9 FM. And Iqbal, what did you think of the candidates we saw?
Surprised there wasn't more back and forth in between the candidates. I found that a lot of them passed their chance to rebuttal and go deep in issues, but some of the ideas they had are very interesting, and I especially like the question asked of the first-year students. I think they gave great insight into what it means to first-years and how to involve first-years more, especially with the dropout rate and everything.
Yeah, it's definitely true. It's definitely something that I very much feel that the elections campaign this year is addressing a lot more than has been in the past. We all know that with such low voter turnout, it's always been a concern. I think they're really reaching out to first years this year, especially going to Totem Park residents and also Place Vanier, which is another first-year residence, which they'll be going to on Monday. And I agree with what you said about their dropout rate question as well. I think one of the candidates had mentioned that there's a 50% dropout rate for first, second, and third years, and this actually sparked probably the most back and forth that we'd actually seen in the entire discussion today, with some saying that this was good as it causes, as UBC does push for over-enrollment. I believe this was Adrian Hajan who said this, and with Imran Habib countering that it shouldn't matter what the university's finances currently are in, because we come to the university for the education, and it should be the students who are the main focus, and the students whose quality of education should be first at hand. But it's definitely true what you said about not so much back and forth as one would typically expect, given that they do have contrasting policies. There was definitely a great deal of discussion, I suppose, and a lot of, I agree with what the former candidate said, and it almost makes one wonder how involved we can be as observers when perhaps we're not as familiar with the policies and can't ask the direct questions, because I feel like a lot of these broad overarching policies say to pay more attention to the student academic life or to create a larger voice for students. I think these are overarching policies which every student can agree with and every candidate would also agree with. And I think it's much more, especially for the Senate, in the nitty-gritty of it,
the
specifics of it, that we can't like really discuss their policy. And it's really hard to do that when we're not too sure of what's going on.
And so next up, we'll have the debate for the VP External.
Yes, I believe so, VP External. Mm-hmm. And the listed candidates for that,
The candidates that are listed for VP External are Catherine Tyson, Michael Wright, and Roy Basil. I apologize for Mitch Wright, excuse me, and Roy Basil. I apologize for mispronouncing any of those.
So that should be exciting to see. Hopefully we have all three candidates here today. I know unless there have been some dropouts from the Senate runners, we were missing two or three of the candidates. Hopefully we have all these individuals here. And I think because it is a much smaller group, it's three people instead of five, perhaps we'll be able to have a bit more one-on-one discussion or
get a bit deeper into the issue.
Exactly, a bit more rebuttal from the different candidates. So should be interesting to see.
There's a moderator for this debate. One of the UBC political science professors will be moderating this next debate for VP External. That'll be interesting.
Definitely will be. It'll be interesting to see, I guess, what we can do. And I think we're just going to take a quick break here, but we'll be back on.
Sounds good.
It's about for you.
What's that?
It's about for you.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM. I'm not going to do that.
Hosted by the man behind me, Dr. Bruce Baum. And just to introduce him, he's an associate professor of poli-sci here at UBC. Some of you either may have been in his classes or have taken classes with him. He's extremely popular, and we're very happy that he would be willing to come down here and moderate the VP External and presidential debates for us. So without further ado, and to get the VP External debate kicked off, Dr. Bruce Baum.
Hi, everybody. This is my opportunity to learn something about student politics, so I felt almost obliged to come down here and do this. So I guess we're going to start off. Everybody's going to kind of introduce themselves to you. I guess, Catherine, we'll start with you, and we'll go down this way for this time, and then we'll switch up the order as we go. So first, we have Catherine Tyson, Mitch Wright, who's in the middle, and Rory Brazil, who's Rory Brazil, who's at this end. So we'll start with Catherine.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out. My name's Catherine Tyson. I'm running to be your next VP External because I'm very passionate about student issues. I'm currently a two-time counselor and the committee chair for the University and External Relations Committee that creates the external policies. I got involved in student politics 2 years ago after seeing the issues that students face, such as the need for better transit and the need for student loan reform. I was always involved in the external portfolio because I feel that that's what best represents students for change. A vote for me is a vote for student-centric policies and making sure that we lift the burden off of students. Thank you, and I hope I can count on your support.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out. My name is Mitch Wright, and I'm currently the Associate VP External, and I'm running this year, obviously, for VP External. I was hired this year because I'm a total research nerd, and our external office wanted to put together some comprehensive reports on issues that affect the cost of education for students. I've been working on the reports, and we've put them out last week. They're on student financial assistance, tuition, and child care. Now, we can lobby the government more effectively than we have ever been able to before, because we have actual data and actual research that demonstrates that education at UBC is more expensive than it has ever been. So I'm very excited for the opportunity to keep working on behalf of students for the next year, and I hope I can count on your support. Thanks very much.
I would just like to thank Dr. Baum for moderating this debate one more time. My name is Rory Brazil, and I'm a third-year philosophy student. I've served on council for 9 months, and that entire time I've been involved in the External Relations Committee. That's the policy committee that is in charge of lobbying the administration and all levels of government on student issues. Among other things, I fought for the preservation of UBC Farm and to keep condos off the bus loop during the land use plan negotiations. But during my entire time on the committee, whenever I brought up the issue, time and time polled as the most pressing for students, that of skyrocketing tuition fees, I was shot down. Despite the fact that in real dollars we paid double the tuition fees of any other time in UBC's history, somehow our elected student reps have managed to frame the opposing tuition fees as a radical or fringe issue, which is patently ridiculous. Are we the victim of such cognitive dissonance that is to believe that the majority of students could hold a fringe opinion? Yes, we need just governance. Yes, we need financial aid reform. And yes, we need better transit. I plan to advocate for all of these things, but we also need tuition fee reform. Vote for me, and I will bring the debate on the cost of education back to the forefront where it belongs. Vote for me to see a true advocate on tuition fees back in office. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to start in the first question, so each have 2 minutes to answer. We'll go through, I'm going to switch up the order each time, and then we'll have 30 seconds for rebuttal. So I'm going to go back the other way, and I'm going to start with Rory on this one. But the question is, the primary role of VP External is to be the AMS's interface with any off-campus organizations and government. In your view, what is the most important relationship the VP or External should be working on improving for the AMS, and why?
Thank you. I think it's pretty clear, given the state of provincial politics right now, the most important relationship we can be fostering and working on are those with other BC student unions. Right now, there's a leadership race between both provincial parties in this province, and the governments here have never been more vulnerable and more in need of our votes than in over a decade. So the relationships I would focus on would be in the construction of our new lobbying group throughout the province, but not to neglect our partners in CASA and not to neglect relationships we build with the administration. Thank you.
Okay, now I'm actually going to go to Catherine. I'll be switching up the order each time. So.
Right now, the most important relationships that we could really be working on are the ones to the actual province themselves. There's an absolute political detriment right now, and we're working on the governance issue. Right now, the province is our oversight, our political oversight mechanism. We have no ability to go to Metro Vancouver anymore. We need to have strong communicational ties to the province to make sure that we can actually represent students on this campus and hold our key policies accountable. Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to agree with Rory. The fact that we are starting relationships with new other student unions across the province in a new lobby group. Last Saturday, Jeremy and I spent hours setting up the framework for a new lobby group to work with other student unions in order to lobby the provincial and federal governments on the cost of education. The new research we've done this year has given us an amazing, amazing opportunity to be able to approach the provincial and federal governments on the issues of childcare, student financial assistance, and tuition. Now, we can work with these other student unions and unify our voices and really affect amazing change on these issues and bring down the cost of education for everyone at UBC. Thank you.
So we have a brief time for rebuttal. I'm going to stick with the same order each round for rebuttal. So, Rory?
I'll pass.
And then Catherine?
I'll pass.
And then Mitch?
I would just love to ask the other candidates what work they've specifically done this year to advance the causes of students on these key issues and work with other student unions or with the provincial government.
Well, my answer was towards governance, because I think that that's a key issue that we're facing in the VP External Portfolio this year. And I was very much involved with the University External Affairs Committee on the university side with the land use plan that directly relates to the governance issues. I feel like I have a bunch of knowledge around that because I dealt with the land use plan so intensely that the consultation process and the ability to wear the Gage South issue, as well as working with campus and community planning, I'll be able to bring that knowledge to the executive portfolio when we're dealing with governance this year.
Am I allowed to respond to this as well? Because 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Well, I have a similar experience with Catherine because I worked on a land use plan with her. But I guess the thing I would say is it's really the experiences and the ties I don't have that make me better able to be an advocate for students. Because I don't have ideological ties to either the provincial parties and no investments therein, I am free to be an advocate for students and students only. So that is what I've been doing. I'm looking out for students' interests and no one else's. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to start with Mitch this time. The AMS is a member of CASA, the Canadian Alliance of Student Associations, a relationship which VP External supervises. What value does this relationship bring to UBC students, and why should UBC students care about it?
The fact is that CASA does amazing lobbying work in the federal arena that we are really not at a good position to do by ourselves. We're located very far away from Ottawa, and we only have a few MPs that are able to advocate on our behalf. When we're able to unite with other student unions in CASA and utilize their resources and their research, we're much more able to affect change in federal policy. So on issues, especially like childcare, which much of the funding comes from the federal government and is distributed by the BC government, we're able to use CASA's resources to really bring about change that would not be possible on our own because the cost would be incredibly prohibitive. Our student union would never be able to lobby as effectively as we can within this organization.
Okay, next, Rory.
Thank you. What I would say is that while federal lobbying is important work, it isn't the most important work. And frankly, the best way we can be lobbying right now is provincially. I think it's pretty clear to everyone when they take stock of the political situation in the province that that's the case. Furthermore, ideological battles between the CFS, the Canadian Federation of Students, and CASA take away from the energy we could be applying here at home. So I would say federal is important, especially as Mitch mentioned on things like such as childcare. But it's not the most important thing. That's provincial. Thank you.
And Catherine.
CASA gives us a lot of information and the ability to tap into a resource for a research group that we might not necessarily have. They also allow for conferences so that we can actually lobby with the federal government. The main thing with that is to be able to push for more transfers to the provincial government. However, they would be doing that regardless. We need to make sure with our deficit on the AMS that we're getting the most for our money this year. That is something that council will need to be able to look at. So far, we've gotten a lot of information from CASA that we necessarily wouldn't have had, but we do need to make sure that we're getting the best results with the money that we give. So far, we have neglected provincial lobbying, and we do need to prioritize that. The province is the one that distributes it, and so we need to make sure that we actually have strong voices within BC for provincial lobbying. CASA has been a great asset. However, we need to reassess if it's still going to be a great asset in the future, and that's something that the council will have to look at. Thank you.
Great. So, round of rebuttals. Mitch, do you have anything you want to add?
No, pass.
Okay. And then Rory?
I guess just one minor point. To go off what Mitch said, we are a long way from Ottawa, and we only do have a few MPs over there. So that means that the influence we can have here at home as the province's biggest educational institution is vastly greater, and every dollar invested in provincial lobbying pays more dividends than that in federal lobbying. Thank you.
Pass.
Okay. Next question, so I'm going to go back to the first order, so I'm going to start with Catherine and then go back this way. Each of the VP external candidates here today lists most or all of the following as platform priorities: student loan or financial assistance reform, transit to and from UBC campus, tuition policy reform, and child care. Can you tell us what differentiates you from your fellow VP candidates? And what, if elected, you would do to go above and beyond the similar platforms? Catherine.
I do mention all of those things because they are very important. One thing that on the student loan reform is different is that I think that we should reform the provincial student loan one and not go into the federal. I know that some of the other ones think that joining the federal one would help us because they have a better repayment strategy. However, I think that we can actually reform the provincial one, which would allow it to be more responsive if crises ever happen to UBC. I think that the provincial student loan reform is very good. Also on my platform, I also include international students as well as graduate students as being key things that we need to lobby for. The VP External deals with all of graduate students, and they're often neglected. We do not get enough research funding for them, and the VP External needs to push for more research grants from the provincial and federal government. As well, we need to make sure that international students get the financial assistance and fast-track visas. And this all falls under VP External because visas fall under the provincial government and federal government. We need to push for that because right now our international students are neglected. Thank you.
Mitch.
As Catherine's pointing out, there are a lot of problems in all these areas, and our platforms are very similar. The difference between myself and the other candidates is that I've been in the office for the past 8 months putting together the research that really demonstrates these problems and putting together the reports that show the solutions. The fact is I've been working for 8 months on behalf of students on these issues, and I'm committed to continuing this work for another year. On the issue of student financial assistance, there's issues like the way housing is assessed. They say you pay $560 a month rent, and then they give you, you know, that much money. But who pays $560 a month rent? I don't know many people that do. On the issue of childcare, the fact is there are 500 spaces on campus for student parents to have their kids during under care during the day while they're studying. There are 1,500 kids on the wait list. There is a crisis in childcare at UBC. And the provincial government is abandoning students by not funding properly childcare expansion. On the issue of tuition, the only reason we have the information that education is more expensive at UBC is because I've spent hours and hours looking through old documents, finding these tuition reports, and finding this data. I emailed UBC asking them for tuition data back 10 or 20 years. It took them 3 weeks to send me 10 years worth of information. So I went through every UBC calendar and figured out, you know what, education is more expensive at UBC than it has ever been. And here are the solutions. I've laid them out in my platform, and the difference is I have been working for 8 months on this, and I will continue to work next year. Thank you.
Rory.
To be clear, I'm not rebutting now. I'm merely answering the question.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
Well, you could say that some of aspects of our platforms are similar. I would disagree for a number of reasons, but student financial aid is important, transit is important, child care is very important. It's 1,500 families, so that could be more kids than actually it is. Governance is important too.
And they think tuition fees are important, but they're kind of vague about what they mean by that. Tuition fees are the elephant in the room in every election campaign. They agree that tuition fees are too high, but the way they're attacking it is to reform debt. We need to provide more grants instead of more loans, and we need to actually lower tuition fees. That's all.
So if anybody has anything to add, Catherine?
I'd just like to rebut Mitch's point. As much as I appreciate the work that he's done, both Rory and I have sat on the committee dealing with the work, and I am also been working for the past year as the University External Relations Committee Chair. We have all been working hard for students' ends. We fully support a lot of the initiatives with the student loan program, the child care needs increasing, and tuition, but you need to be able to look past that and actually look at the full scope of the VP external portfolio, and he does not do this. He neglects international students as well as graduate students.
Mitch. Yeah. I would disagree. There's a whole section in my report on international student tuition. I haven't gone in-depth on my platform, but I do have a number of positions that I've taken on that, and I communicated them to a student today who did inquire. On the issue of international student tuition, the fact is UBC just came out with another proposal saying they're going to increase it by 4% this year. That is ridiculous. That is absolutely ridiculous. They're using a figure, the Higher Education Price Index, that says, 3% is what we need to account for. Well, CPI was only less than 1% this year. They're increasing international student tuition at a rate that is absurd, and it is unfair to international student tuitions.
And Rory.
Yeah, I guess I have to say that I think it's pretty rich for Mitch to suggest that it took a report on tuition for us to realize that tuition is too high. Advocates for lower tuition have been saying the same thing since 1996 when they started to, when they unfroze tuition fees. It's pretty clear if you ask people if their education is affordable or not that it's not. On the subject of international students, I agree, Mitch, that's ridiculous. I read the same report and I'm outraged. I'm also outraged that this school, this administration, and frankly AMS treats them as second-class citizens. They should have the same democratic rights because they pay more. Thank you.
Okay, a new question, and this time I'm going to start with Rory and then go to Catherine and then to Mitch. Lobbying the provincial and federal governments on behalf of AMS and UBC students is a large part of VP external portfolio. I think this is something that people have talked about already a little bit. Of particular interest to many students is the issue of large burden of FARC financial aid that many build before graduating. What do you feel that the VP external's time and resources are best spent on to ensure students are getting the financial aid they need?
So I'm going to keep this brief because I think the facts are pretty clear. Student financial aid in this province is a joke. You know it, I know it, and my opponents know it. I will lobby for a better repayment plan and a lowering of the interest rate of the BC loans to the prime interest rate with the eventual goal of having interest-free loans. But again, the elephant in the room is tuition fees, because without tuition fee reform, all we're doing is offering students debt reform. If we are ever going to make education affordable again in this province, we have to reduce tuition fees and push for more grant-based system. Thank you.
Okay, Catherine.
This is laid out in my platform as well. Student loan reform is a huge thing that I want to push for. We need to look at when people actually come in here, they're not getting enough money. And also the access to the student loans are very hard to do. We need to reform the liquid assets part of the student loan program. Right now, if your parents have a mortgage, they often have to remortgage their homes. The provincial government expects them to. They're expected to not have any savings. They're expected not to help you. You also, if you have a car, let's just say that's over $5,000, you're expected to sell it, even though we're known to be a community school. We need to reassess the liquid assets so that it's actually reasonable for students to actually get the student loans. And the government needs to actually reassess that. We also need to reassess how much money people get when they actually come to school. We need to focus on giving people the resources that they need so that they can flourish at this university. Right now you get $560 for rent. You get very little for food. We need to be able to increase that to what the actual regional area like Vancouver is, which is usually around $800 a month. This is something that the provincial government needs to know so that there's not a shortfall. The repayment program needs to be reformed as well. We need an extended payback period because right now we're in a situation where we have, it's very hard for students after graduation to find a job. It's right now 6 months. It can be increased to 9 months or to 12 months without interest being accumulated so that people can actually compete with those on internships during the summer, find the jobs, and then actually pay it back in a reasonable amount. Of course, I'm for lowering the interest as well, but we need to make sure that once people start paying the interest rate back, that they can actually do it and actually have the employment capabilities. But while they're at school, which was what the question asked, they need to have the money to actually flourish here. We need to lift the burden off of students, and as your VP external, I will do that and prioritize that. Thank you.
Mitch.
Yep. One of the key problems with the Student Aid BC is that it's not integrated with the federal student aid program, which is Canada's student loan program. Almost every other province in the country has decided to move their offices to Ottawa and thereby become more efficient and reduce costs. That's why their interest rates in other provinces are lower than BC's. BC's has the highest. When you repay your loans, you have to pay back at prime plus 2.5%. That is higher than every other province in the country because we have our offices in Victoria. I don't know if you've had to do this, but every time I call Canada Student Loans and I say, I have a question about, you know, this part of my loans, they say, oh, you have to talk to BC about that. So I have to get off the phone and then wait another 45 minutes to talk to BC. That's ridiculous. The fact is, like, these are the same programs, essentially, running in two completely different provinces. We need to integrate them to reduce costs, and that's how the interest rate is going to come down. Additionally, Catherine mentioned the repayment assistance plan. BC's repayment assistance plan right now, if you graduate and you're making, say, $22,000 a year over a $21,000 limit, you cannot get your interest rate, your payments reduced. The federal program takes a look at the actual amount of income you earn. So if you're earning $36,000 a year, which is, you know, still not much for graduating university, they'll actually take a look at the amount of income you earn and adjust your payment schedule so that you can actually afford it. BC doesn't care. If you make $26,000 a year, they say you still have to pay back, say, $600 a month. You can't afford that. That's ridiculous. Okay, and finally, the assessment mechanisms, which Catherine also mentioned, they look at your rent, they look at food, and they look at other aspects of cost of living, and all of their assessments are well below actual costs. So when you get your loans, you're not getting enough money. I know I've been in the same situation. That's why I work two jobs to pay for my rent. It's difficult to be on student loans in BC, and that's why we need these simple reforms to make sure that students can afford their education. Thank you.
Okay, we'll do a quick round of rebuttals or additions, and I think we started with Rory.
Yeah, I guess to reiterate and summarize what my opponent just said, the student financial aid in this province is a big fucking joke, and we all know it.
Radio.
We have to pursue every avenue to make education more accessible for students. That includes student financial aid reform, providing childcare, making sure transit is accessible, but it also includes tuition fee reform. And don't let them tell you differently. Thank you.
Catherine.
Just to rebut a little bit of what Mitch's points were is that he wants to join the federal system. As was with CASA, it's much harder to actually lobby someone when they're in Ottawa. Right now, I think that we need, if we're actually thinking that provincial government deals with all of our education, if there is a crisis in BC, Ottawa is very much outside of our scope. Having an actual provincial federal loan system helps us a lot, and I want to reform the provincial system and not move them to Ottawa because the province has its ears open, is willing to talk to us, and we need to try to reform our system now than try and just move it to Ottawa. Thank you.
I would like to rebut that point by saying having a provincial office for our student loans does not help anybody because it keeps the interest rate high. It keeps it higher than every other province in the country. Countries or provinces that are integrating with the federal program are able to reduce their interest rates. We've seen that in the last few years. Numerous provinces have been able to do that. So if we have a provincial office that's, you know, we appeal to, the fact is we're still paying more than students in every other province. Why would we care if the office is in Ottawa or if it's in Victoria when we're having to pay more than every other province? That's ridiculous.
Okay, we have time for one last question, I think, and then if there are any further rebuttals, people can add in their final closing statements, I guess. So the last question, I'm going to start with Mitch and then go to Rory and then Catherine. It has recently been announced by AMS that a possible fee referendum will occur at the same time as the UPass renewal referendum in March. Do you agree or disagree with attaching additional referenda items to the UPass referendum, and what are the benefits or disadvantages to doing so?
I would prefer that they not be attached to the UPass referendum. Well, attached in what sense? Are you saying it's the same vote? If you vote for the UPass, you vote for everything? Because I think students should have the option to vote for each individual thing that they want. If they do not want, say, a fee for a certain group or a certain type of a benefit, then they should be able to reject that. But if they want the UPass fee increased, then they should be able to accept that. I don't think they should be tied. I think we should have as much choice as possible, and that's what students should probably want.
Rory.
Thank you. Absolutely, I think they should be. I'm actually a member of the referendum committee, and I firmly believe that that is the most important committee in the society right now, because if this fee referendum doesn't fail, or if it doesn't pass, the AMS as we know it simply ceases to exist. So I would say, yes, tie them, because we need this to succeed, and we need it so we can even have a UPass program provided by an AMS that still exists. But make them earn their money. If they are going to charge you more fees, then demand that they be better advocates. Thank you.
Catherine.
I would tie them, but tying them doesn't mean that if you don't like one of the bylaw changes or one of the other fee referendum changes, that you can't vote it down. It just means that they're happening at the same time. I think that having them at the same time allows for quorum to be met, because it really engages students, because students really care about the UPass. We can get a bunch of communications going together at once and really articulate ourselves to you. We need better communication in the AMS, and one way to do that is to tie them with things like the UPass that are really important, that catch people's attention, to also say, yes, we have something going on with the referendum, we are in a budgetary deficit, and we need this help. I'm also on the referendum committee, and I think it's a... I've been on the referendum committee since the beginning of its formation, months ago, even before it was reformed. And I think it's a huge deal. We need to be able to actually provide the services that we do now. We've had the same amount of money coming in since the 1980s, and yet we've expanded our services. It hasn't kept up to inflation. Right now, we pay such low fee amounts that we do need to increase it, but we are articulating within the referendum committee how much do we need to increase it by to be able to sustain, because we understand that students have a limited budget, and we need to be able to actually take only what we need from you, and then to provide the services that we do. And it's unbelievably important, and I think that any other bylaw changes that are coming need to be tied with it so that we make sure that we have quorum, because without quorum, you can't actually pass anything else. And usually, during the UPass, you have quorum. So I would tie them, but that does not mean that you have to, if you say yes to the UPass, you say yes for everything else. They're individual votes. Thank you.
Okay, we'll have a quick round of rebuttals. Mitch, or additions?
Well, I have nothing to rebut. It's just thank you for clarifying. As long as students are able to make the decision on each individual question, they should be tied and done at the same time, because that's very important that we get everything that needs to be passed, passed.
Rory.
To be clear, is this a rebuttal or this closing remarks and
it's
rebuttal?
It's a rebuttal.
Okay.
Or an addition to the last question.
I suppose all I would say then is that I joined referendum committee when it was reformed because the work wasn't getting done. And since then, we've made incredible progress, and I'm thrilled with the results we produced so far, and I believe we'll get it done. I believe we'll save the society. I believe we'll save the student union. Thank you.
Catherine.
I encourage all of you to look at the referendum when it comes up in the next couple months. It's going to be a huge deal. We need it. Criticize it if you must, but just have a conversation about it, because we need one, and we need one about the bylaws that are going to be attached to it as well. So I encourage you all to look at that. Thank you.
Okay, now we're going to shift over to closing remarks, and I'm going to go back through my first order. I'm going around in a little rotation here. So I'm going to start with Catherine and then go to Mitch and then go to Rory. So, closing remarks.
I'm running for VP External because I'm very passionate about these issues. I know I said that at the beginning, but it's true. I'm dedicated to students, and I really want to put them first. I want a holistic approach to the VP External portfolio, and I want to make sure that we listen to you, communicate with you, and actually put council, the committees, and students in the actual seat that makes the decisions. We need to make sure that as VP External, we listen to you. We actually work together to actually provide for students on student loan reform, better transit, and an increased government structure, because right now we have none. We need to make sure that students are represented in a government structure. I have the knowledge, I have the experience, and I have the dedication to be able to do this. I hope that I can count on your support. Thank you very much.
Mitch.
Yeah, in my role as AVP External this year, I'm incredibly proud of the work that we've put together, giving the AMS an amazing framework to be able to lobby the federal and provincial governments on key issues that affect the cost of education and access to UBC. On issues like transit, tuition, student financial aid, and childcare, we've finally given the AMS comprehensive, well-researched reports and policy that we can go to the provincial and federal governments with to conclusively say education is more expensive than it's ever been, and you need to do something about it. So please support me. Go to mitchwright.ca and check out my platform, and I hope I can count on your support. Thank you.
Rory.
Thank you. I think I've been pretty clear on my positions throughout this debate, though I wish we'd had time to explore issues around governance and transit more thoroughly. I would love if you would come up and talk to me about those things afterwards, because I think they're incredibly important as well. I have the experience and the skills to get the job done, and most of all, because I have no desire to pursue a career in politics, I'm able to pursue sensible policies that work for students, free from party politics or ideological loyalties that don't work for students. Vote for me, and let's talk about tuition fees again. Vote for me, let's start a dialogue. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for the candidates for answering the questions directly, and thanks everybody for turning out. It's a good turnout. That's a good thing to see for student engagement here, and that closes this session. So thanks a lot, everybody.
Thank you.
Folks, we're going to take like a 2 or 3 minute break once again just between now, and we'll be back with the presidential debate. So don't go anywhere. Stay tuned. And if the presidential candidates could come up front, we would greatly appreciate that.
Heard. The debate for the position of VP External for the AMS brought to you live from the Totem Park residence. I'm Claire Eagle. I'm joined here with Iqbal Ahmed, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. So the candidates that we just heard speak were Catherine Tyson, Rory Brasil, and Mitch Wright, all three of whom have had some experience in various departments of the AMS or as counselors in some form of student administration, and who did bring very different perspectives to the position. So, Iqbal, what were your thoughts?
I thought it was very interesting how they all talked about different strategies on how to lobby for UBC in provincial and federal government. They had an interesting discussion about what it was more important to focus on, provincial government or federal government, because the entire role of VP External seems to be to, you know, represent UBC interests outside the university. And they all brought very different perspectives to it. They, I believe the vote between the three would be a vote more on strategy and direction than on any platform.
Strength, dignity, respect, beauty, self-worth, safety, confidence, choice, hope. The Beauty Night Society is a registered charity dedicated to helping marginalized women introduce trust, hope, and self-esteem into their lives. This is the first day of Through its popular makeover program, the Beauty Night Society has touched the lives of thousands and reintroduced a healthy touch to the lives of vulnerable women throughout British Columbia, creating real life makeovers. Please visit www.beautynight.org for information on programs and on how to help. Beauty Night, because dignity is beautiful. I think I was blind
before I met you. Mom, I gotta say, I liked your hair better before.
I'm not gonna make it into work today, sir. I'm really tired.
You know, honey, on second thought, that dress does make you look fat.
Unfortunately, we aren't all blessed with a verbal filter to keep us out of awkward situations. We are, however, born with a natural set of filters, our kidneys. Kidneys work to regulate water and reduce waste, ensuring our bodies operate at their top performance. March is Kidney Health Month. Take care of your kidneys. They may be the only filter you have. For more information about your amazing kidneys, visit kidney.bc.ca.
Thank you.
Going to practice our continental way of eating. We pick up our silverware, index finger in the back of the fork, index finger on top of the knife.
What's the matter? Doesn't that sound exciting to you?
Luckily, dining at the Sub is a little less formal.
Pi R Squared, located in the main concourse of the Sub.
Pi R Squared was voted the best pizza by The Slice in Canada, by its own staff. The joint always has a great vegetarian selection, is now offering cheeseless pizza. Open 10 a.m. till late, 7 days a week. This business is owned and operated by the AMS, your student society.
Jeremy McElroy in the center, and Omar Shaban in your left. And I'm gonna start this round with Omar, and then go to Jeremy, and then go to Michael. So first question. So I guess we're gonna do 2 minutes for answers. You have up to 2 minutes for answers, and we'll do 30 minutes if you want to add anything or add a rebuttal. For each question. Oh, sorry, yes. Introductions, yes, so go ahead.
I have to start?
You get to start.
Well, hello, my name is Omar Shaban, and I'm running for the president of the AMS. My job is essentially a professional lobbyist and activist. I'm not a politician. So I stand up for what really matters for students, and I take on really controversial issues. They're really hard to solve, but I'm really adamant on solving them. Those include skyrocketing tuition fees, as they call them, the elephant in the room. And as somebody said on Twitter, somebody should just bring an elephant. I'm going to be talking about the elephant in the room. I'm also going to be lobbying for better exam hardship policies, and I will lobby for better representation of demographics on campus and banning water bottles at the AMS. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Jeremy McElroy, and I'm the current Vice President External. So I was sitting around this table here last year, and I made a number of promises of things that I wanted to see happen. First and foremost was to create a provincial lobby group, and last week, as one of the other candidates said, I did sit down with leaders from across this province, and we drafted the final bylaws for an organization that will likely be coming into existence next month. The awkwardness of our elections means that I'm kind of a week behind, but I followed through on that. Additionally, through my work with CASA, through my work with TransLink, and the rapid transit campaign that we had, I've demonstrated time and time again that I am a strong voice for students, that I am a strong team leader, and that I will do everything in my power to ensure that the voices of UBC students are heard loud and clear, that the executive team is led well, and that all projects are well supported. Thank you.
And Michael.
Hi, everyone. My name is Michael Moll. I'm an international student from Kenya. I'm running for AMS president because I believe fundamentally that the AMS needs to reach out to more students. I hear a lot of candidates always speaking about lobbying. I'm here to represent students now and in the present. I'm running on the campaign that I want to build communications so students don't have to come to me when I'm campaigning and say, what is the AMS? What are the issues? I believe that, you know, to run an effective team is the goal of every leader. To actually communicate that to people and engage them is the most important thing we need at the AMS right now. We're not fighting against each other. We're fighting against voter apathy because they're not stakeholders. I'm here to build the AMS and increase the stakeholders and to build the leaders on campus so they can actually care about what they care about and do it better. I think that's the most important thing the AMS needs to do because the AMS is here to serve students and to prove their life on campus now. Lobbying is an essential part, but I still think we must look to the students who are already at the university and see how we can help their experience better. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you all for your opening statements. And I'm going to start with Michael for my first question here. One of the many roles the AMS president has is regarding the leading and maintaining of tight working relationship dynamics of an executive team that has been elected independently. If you are elected president, what are some of the concrete steps that you would take to ensure that this team functions at a high and effective level? So Michael.
Okay. Well, the first thing I think is, being on leadership positions all across campus, the most important thing about a team, especially being a leader, is to listen to your team. I think the first step that I'm going to make when any of the candidates get elected, and if I get elected, is to sit down with them individually and find out what their goals are and listen to them. I believe the president is supposed to be the number one supporter of his executives, and that's really the role I want to play. I feel if you ask anybody I work with, I'm one of the biggest motivators, and so I really want to support their platforms and see their work gets done. The second thing after sitting down with them individually is really to make sure that they connect with each other well and that they're really using each other as a resource. I think the best thing is for the president not to step over his executives, but really to show them that they're the ones who are the experienced people. So, for example, the VP finance, the VP admin, they're the ones who are here to come and really bridge those portfolios and make them better. The president's here to support those actions. And I'm going to make it clear from day one that I'm here to support them just as I'm here to support students because they're here to support students. And I think if we have clear communication within the executive from the get-go, I think that's really what's going to set the tone.
Great. I'm switching around the order, so I'll get to everybody going first, and I'm trying to make this as fair as possible. So I'm going to go over to Omar.
Well, the independent executives are chosen by the students, so I can't really tell them exactly what to do. So my job is to understand better their platforms, preferably before they get elected, so study the platforms of all the candidates so I can be prepared after, and then sit together with them and ask them what exactly they want to do. Of course, I have my own platform, and if I get elected, I need to follow exactly what the students wanted me to do. So we'll have to find a balance between my platform and the candidates' platforms. Of course, I prefer to have progressive candidates like me so I can work together more effectively and lobby for lower tuition fees even more effectively.
Jeremy.
Executive cohesion over the last 2 years deteriorated rapidly, sort of coming into the first semester of the school year. This is in due part to the actions of the last two presidents in not listening to the executives. I've experienced this firsthand. I'm on the current executive, and I understand that that when a president steps on your toes, when a president commandeers a project, and when a president keeps you away from the media, it's detrimental to the working environment. So those are essentially the things that I would make sure not to do, the complete opposite of. Supporting, not commandeering projects, giving full media rights to all of my vice presidents to be able to talk about their projects, to take credit and to get the praise for the projects that they're working on. And last but not least is the president coordinates a team. As Omar said, it's important that you all sort of have similar ideological goals when you're getting there, but the reality is that that's not necessarily going to be the case. Dealing with five people independently elected in races means that you all have very different ideas of what you think the AMS should be doing, what you want to do, and where you think society should be going. And it's the president's job to act as a mediator, to find that compromise, and to create a coordinated executive team that gets a lot done with a diversity of opinions on the executive. So again, full media rights, not commandeering projects, and giving support, not taking it away.
Right, we're going to go to the same order for rebuttals or additions. So, Michael, if you have anything to add.
Yes, just something to add. I think, just in this same framework, the most important thing, I think, is not just to give their executives media attention, but I think is to also give them a platform to share what they're doing. I think, I sat here and I watched just the last debate where one of the gentlemen was talking about the work that he had done. I think it's really a sad point if someone who's been working on projects for 8 months, the first time that the general public hears about it is at a debate like this. I think giving each executive a platform, whether it be blog space or whether it be through social media, to actually engage with their constituents, then the credit will come when they actually come to fruition of their projects.
Omar.
I have nothing to add.
Jeremy, do you want to add anything?
The reason that the particular issue was kept under wraps until recently was for legal reasons, as well as previous efforts to create such a lobby group have actually failed because word got out and competing student organizations commandeered it and destroyed it. So there was intention to the silence on that issue.
Okay, great. The next question I'm going to ask sort of follows up on something that Jeremy raised the last round. So it could be said that each of the past two AMS presidents started strong, only later to find that taking actions that they felt were correct ones closer to the end of their terms ended up causing strong divisions in the council. One president was subject to an impeachment referendum, and another was subject to a censor motion. If you are elected, how do you feel you will be able to ensure that your agenda doesn't cross paths with those on the AMS Council? So this round, I'm starting with Jeremy.
Given that I've kind of been at the forefront of both the impeachment and the censure movements for both the executives, I'd like to believe that I've learned from the previous two presidents' mistakes. I believe that my time on council has, I have demonstrated that I'm the voice of reason, that I am the mediator, that I do command the confidence of the people that I work with, and I will carry that on as president. The president, as I said, is responsible for coordinating a team, is for being a strong voice around council, but at the end of the day, they must defer to council. I will not let my own personal agenda, my own personal beliefs, stand in the way of what council wants me to do.
Michael.
Just to add to that, I think I fully agree with Jeremy. I think, you know, as a president, you must really be impartial, and going to council first and letting council decide is the most important thing. My addition to that is I challenge council to step up and really be the voice of the students, because, you know, the council represents undergraduate societies across, and I think, you know, watching over the previous issues, it was very clear that certain councillors, you know, didn't want to get involved, even though it was such a controversial issue, but it is them who has to decide, and I think showing the telling councillors and making them know that their voice is really the voice that's going to carry issues, and giving them the full support to air their opinions, be it for or against, I think is the most important thing the president needs to do, and then they will come to a solution that will be beneficial to students, since students have elected them in.
Omar.
I'm going to say something extremely controversial right now. UBC insiders. So first off, my answer is going to be two parts. The first part is you have to listen to your council. Council members are directly elected by the students, and they are the voice of the students. However, the president is also elected by the students directly, and there is a platform that he ran on. So if there is something that he ran on and students want and students voted for, it is that something that is, the president should stand up for, even if council disapproves. If the students voted for the president so that he would lobby for lower tuition fees, it does not matter if council does not want lower tuition fees. He should still lobby for tuition fees. If the president lobbied for banning water bottles, I don't care if council doesn't want to ban water bottles. I'm going to lobby to ban water bottles. Well, here you go, UBC insiders.
Okay, we have time for rebuttals here. Jeremy, do you have anything you want to add or rebut?
I guess, while it is true that a president gets elected on their particular platform, at the end of the day, it's the democratic will of council that determines what the AMS does. So, again, the president is elected to certain ideals, but it's sort of, it's democracy of the whole, not democracy of the one. So, if whatever the president believes has to be sort of directed by council in addition to, you know, their own personal platform.
Michael.
Just to add to that, I think, you know, when it comes to ethics and values, I will always stand by mine, and I will always respect the council. But I also feel that, you know, as long as the president is not using up the resources of the AMS or doing anything that would be detrimental to the AMS, I think that the president can still, you know, help out students or lobby for things that they believe in, as long as it doesn't go against the AMS. Waiting for council to make decisions is good, but to be as a president, I will be proactive in the things that I believe in, but I will always be in check by council.
Okay, my next question, I'm going to start back with Omar. The AMS president sits on the board of the UBC Alumni Association. If elected, how would you best leverage this position to engage the alumni with the priorities of the AMS, particularly in regards to the top priorities of your vice president, such as lobbying and influencing the government?
Well, the alumni have been at UBC longer than me, so they know better, and they have better experience. So, of course, I'm going to ask them for advice. I'm going to be listening to them. But in the end, it is the will of the students that prevail. So alumni are alumni. They probably do not benefit or are harmed by whatever policies the AMS take. Again, It is the AMS Council and the students who really matter to the president in the end. If, as I said before, if the students want a certain policy, it is the students that I go to before anybody else.
Great. Jeremy.
UBC has a vast and prestigious alumni. We have chief justices, politicians, managing directors of hospitals, board members of TransLink. UBC has connections to some of the most powerful and influential people in this province, a quarter million, no less. So and while we are 46,000 strong, they are 250,000 strong. So it's definitely a resource that the AMS has not been tapping into as well as it should. This year, the Alumni Association took the first step in creating a series of roundtables, which is where they would invite politicians to sit down with sort of a random group of alumni and talk about existing issues with UBC and ways that we can work together. I had the benefit of sitting on one of those, we worked towards figuring out a way to integrate UBC programming in the new False Creek project, so the mixed-use housing that's happening down there, and a number of other areas. So engaging Humanities 101 and the Learning Exchange to better work with sort of the new East Side that's creating out there. So there are many opportunities for the AMS to work with these organizations. I think we should be leveraging those relationships, not defaming or burning any bridges along the way, which has been what the last few executives have unnecessarily done.
Thank you.
Alumni has actually been on my campaign platforms. I said we really need to leverage these connections. First off, I think it really comes with setting up the strategic vision of the AMS for that year or for those couple of years, and then making sure that we have mapped out where our alumni are and see where they can help us with our vision. But to build on that, I was actually the alumni correspondent for my fraternity, and I worked with alumni from various different capacities. But mainly, I think one thing that we really need to look at is our young alumni. I'm only going to be in office for a year, but I think what we need to set up a framework where UBC is really dealing with young alumni and engaging them before they're famous, before they have money, before they have power. Because if we can take care of them in the years when they've just graduated, they don't have that community anymore, and we're saying that we're still here for you even though you're no longer a current student, it'll pay off. I think we need to start sowing seeds instead of looking for right now benefits, because the alumni don't owe us anything. But if we can give them something first, then hopefully later on it'll pay off. So I really think engaging young alumni and making sure we're giving them all the support possible is a step that the AMS and UBC should take. Thank you.
So we'll start back with rebuttals this round or additions. Omar.
I just would like to add that it is, as Jeremy said, extremely important to learn from the alumni and build connections with them and learn from their experience. However, it is very dangerous to assume that to focus on just that, because again, as I said, alumni are alumni. Even if they're professional experienced, they know better perhaps, but it is the students who are affected first and the students that we should listen to first.
Jeremy.
That is true. These are the movers and shakers. These are the people that we haven't necessarily done as good a job reaching out to proving that we are serious adults to be taken seriously and not children brandishing toy weapons. So we need to do a much better job of bringing decorum and professionalism to our engagement with them, and hopefully they can help us in all of our objectives.
Michael.
Just to build on that, I fully agree. I think the number one thing that the AMS president needs to be able to do is to sit at any table with any organization, be their alumni, be their external, be their internal, and have professional and progressive conversations with them. I think a president who can carry himself that way, or herself, sorry, that way, is really going to be able to leverage these existing opportunities. So I do believe that, as president, I feel that, the way I would carry myself would benefit students, because I would be able to go to alumni in any capacity and really reach out to them and tell them, this is what students care of. Can you help us?
Thank you all. Next question. So now I'm starting with Michael, and then I'm going to go to Omar, and then to Jeremy. AMS Council has recently announced the plans to hold a referendum this coming March with the intention of asking students to vote to raise their AMS fees for the first time in over 25 years. Should this referendum fail, the VP Finance will be forced to make difficult budget cuts to the tune of $140,000 to prevent the deficit. Although the budget is not in the president's purview, Where can AMS save this money? Michael.
I'd just like to start off by saying I think the referendum is very essential. I think, you know, it goes back to my platform. The real problem here is the lack of communication. I think right now, you know, the AMS is saying, how are we going to be able to process a referendum? How are we going to communicate to students? Is because they don't have the adequate channels to talk to students. If we actually build these and secure them, then whenever these things come about, we can actually have honest conversation with students saying, this is what the AMS offers. And the problem is that's what we're struggling now, is to tell students what the AMS offers. This is what will happen if this doesn't pass, and this is what we're going to lose. I think where the AMS can save money is they're going to have to trim all the budgets. I think everyone's going to have to take a cut back, because realistically, if students say through referendum that they're not going to support this society with any more money, then I think what's going to happen is they're going to have to see a smaller society. And I think the reality is that cuts will come. I can't say where the cuts will come. I haven't seen the full budget completely, but I believe that's going to be a job for the whole entire exec team and council to decide where those cuts will come. But I think if students say they don't want the referendum, cuts will come. Some students will be unhappy, but then students will know that they voted in that referendum, that fee didn't pass, and this is the result. The conversations that are not happening is everyone wants to lower tuition, wants to do this, but where will the money come from? I think we need to start having honest conversations about, you know, when you take from one side, you have to fill it back in. And so if we can't add more money to our budgets, then we're going to have to make cuts. And I think that's the honest conversation that I'm going to have with students. And once students know what the great service the AMS offers, I think they'll pass the referendum. And if they won't, then we'll all know how small the AMS can be. Thank you.
Okay. Oh. Omar.
I was at the last AMS council meeting, which was awesome, by the way. And there was a presentation on the referendum coming up. And with the type of work that Ben and the executive are doing, I really think that it's going to pass and we will not face this problem. However, if we do face this problem, then I have no idea which services we're going to cut. It's not up to me in the end. It's up to council members and the committees that will form to investigate and look into the kind of services that the AMS provides to students and decide on which ones we're supposed to just get rid of. It's not up to me. Thank you.
Jeremy.
Being on the executive, having to deal with the cuts in the spring, and now taking a look at the current deficit and having to figure out what we're going to do in the fall, I know that there is no money. That there is no money to cut. If we go through and we cut every little bit, all of our advocacy budgets, all of our project budgets, all of our student outreach budgets, it still falls short of the deficit. I don't think everyone understands how bare bones the AMS is currently operating. We have relied on our businesses for far too long. We've relied on growing enrollment as opposed to growing our own resources. And now we're left at a point where the market realities have slapped us in the face and said, all right, now you owe me $250,000. So, we have to pass this referendum. I cannot stress that enough. Thinking in terms of, well, if it doesn't pass,